And now you know the reason I do this godforsaken job. I have to know why. Chapter 22. By 7 a.m., Gus was dressed and ready to leave the house. He had to go into the office to check the mail and reroute a few assignments before the weekend. The rest of the day was set aside for the latest brainstorm on finding Beth. He threw on his coat, grabbed his keys, and started down the hall. Carla was asleep in the guest room, the door shut. The door to Morgan's room, however, was half open. He stopped and peeked inside. She was an ill-defined mound on the mattress, asleep somewhere beneath a heap of blankets. He stood in the doorway, watching in silence. Yesterday, he had made several attempts to have that serious talk with her. The right moment never arrived. Morgan had made sure of it. She was surely in pain from the loose tooth she'd yanked out prematurely, but she was making more of it than she might have. She'd spent the whole day in bed. Gus had visited her room a dozen times to talk. Light conversation was fine. Whenever he had tried to steer the conversation toward Beth, however, she suddenly needed sleep, another pillow, or a story read to her. It was frustrating, but he didn't want to force it. After the horror of that newscast on Tuesday night, talking on any level was a positive. He checked his watch. He needed to get going, but his feet wouldn't move. His gaze drifted across the room, a little girl's dreamland. Tiny ballerinas danced in synchronized patterns on the walls, the curtains, and matching quilt. Minnie Mouse guarded the toy chest beneath the window. Barbie was parked in her pink convertible beside the bed. Gus had paid for all of it. He had selected none of it. It was all Beth's doing. Morgan was all Beth's doing. The room was so peaceful, deceptively so. He wondered what was going on inside her head, deep beneath the covers. He could only guess. One thing, however, rang clear in the silence. He had something to tell her, something that couldn't wait. Gently, he pushed the door the rest of the way open and stepped closer. A 3-foot teddy bear was in the rocking chair beside the bed. Gus removed it and lowered himself quietly onto the quilted cushion. He whispered softly, almost mouthing her name. Morgan. She didn't stir. He drew a deep breath. It didn't matter that she was asleep. He had to get it off his chest. His eyes closed, then opened. He spoke in a low, hoarse whisper. I came to see you last night, he said, a lump in his throat. But you were already asleep. The ball beneath the blankets was perfectly still, save for her breathing. He continued. Your books were scattered on the floor, so I picked them up and put them on the shelf. That's when I noticed the little marks on the inside of the closet door. Little lines, all about a half inch apart. The first one was about 2 feet off the ground. The next one a little higher, up and up and up. Each one had a date beside it. Your mother's handwriting. I just stood there and stared. It shocked me. Seeing how you had grown, all the time that had passed. It was literally the writing on the wall. Your mother had been there for you every inch of the way. The first step, the first word, the first day of school. All the big days in your little life, and the not-so-big days. Day in and day out, your mommy was there. He glanced toward the closet, his gaze unfocused. And all I could think was, where the heck was I? I missed it. I've missed all of it. His eyes welled, the voice cracked. When I woke up this morning, I felt even worse. I realized that Monday was the first time I'd ever picked you up from school. Yesterday, with your bloody tooth, was the first weekday morning we've ever spent together, just the two of us. I don't understand how that happened, how time gets away. I just wish it didn't take your mother's disappearance to make your father wake up. He laid his hand on the covers gently so as not to wake her. I just wanted to say, I'm sorry. I know it doesn't count when you're sleeping, but I truly am sorry. And I couldn't wait to tell you that. He was motionless in the rocking chair. It was hard to say where the rush of emotion was coming from, but it was coming, unstoppable. It was as if the whole horrendous week were racing to a head. The fears about Beth, the rejection from Morgan, the sparring with Carla and snakes at the law firm. He was a smart guy. He could handle a law firm. Only with things that really mattered was he utterly powerless. Slowly he noticed movement beneath the covers. He didn't want to wake her, but he felt the urge to give her a hug. He waited for her to come around, but the movement stopped. Morgan, he said softly. He heard a click that sounded mechanical, followed by muffled music. He gently tugged the blanket, peeling away the top layer, exposing the back of Morgan's head. A black wire was tangled in her hair. It ran to her ear. She was wearing headphones, listening to music. She had turned it up so loud even Gus could hear it 3 feet away. The sight crushed him. She had been awake throughout. She had heard everything. He waited a few moments, hoping her eyes would open. They didn't. The garbled music just kept coming from the headphones. Without uttering a word, her response was loud and clear. She had nothing to say to him. Slowly, sadly, he rose from the rocking chair and walked out the door. Andy left the federal building around 3:30, her first opportunity for a lunch break. Victoria hadn't asked for one, but Andy was preparing a summary of the common behavioral indicators exhibited in all four murders. She wasn't so presumptuous as to take a stab at the actual criminal profile, though she was quietly hoping that Victoria might suggest it. Isaac Underwood caught her on her way out the door. Seems the lunch schedule for the assistant special agent in charge was also on a 3-hour delay. He hustled down the granite steps till his gait was even with hers. Mind if I join you? Actually, I was headed over to the market. Good deals toward the end of the day. Mind if I walk with you? I was going to take the bus. Not a good place to talk business. Come on, the walk will do you good. As they covered the long 5 blocks up First Avenue to Pike Place Market, Andy filled him in on the latest developments, including the rendezvous with Martha Goldstein. A light north breeze was in their face, but gloves, overcoats, and a very brisk pace kept off the chill. Traffic, both cars and pedestrians, got heavier as they neared the historic market. It was nothing like a sunny summer afternoon, however, when the chance of winning the state lottery was better than finding a parking spot. Pike Place was the nation's oldest continuously operating farmer's market, and with as many as 40,000 visitors daily, it was to many the heart and soul of Seattle. The 2.5-block stretch was prime for people watching, or it was just as fun to explore the many old buildings that had been strung together over the years by ramps, alleys, and stairways. The city council had forbade singing by market vendors since 1947, but that didn't dampen the loud and continuous hawking of everything, from Guatemalan cigars and Turkish pastries to African violets and Pacific Northwest salmon. No chain stores or franchises were allowed, which made it a true bazaar, not another mall. Andy headed toward the main arcade, a semi-open area facing the street. About half of the fresh produce stalls were there, side by side with the gleaming rows of fresh crab and halibut in angled iced beds. The crowds weren't peak, but there was still a steady stream of shoppers. A magician performed tricks beneath the big market clock. A guitarist on the corner sang an old Jimmy Buffett tune. A fishmonger hurried by with a very recently deceased eel draped over each shoulder. Andy's eye was on the live Maine lobsters at the bottom of the big glass tank, but Isaac was still talking business. How are you and my old buddies at Seattle PD getting along? Good, I think. She stopped at arcade number 8 to check out the homegrown Asian vegetables, one of the sure signs that spring was coming to Seattle. You hear differently? I had lunch with Detective Kessler yesterday. Tells me you learned a valuable lesson with that leak to the newspapers about the bookend theory. Yeah. Never again do I tell him anything that isn't fit to print. Actually, he thought you two had reached an understanding. If there's something you don't want in the papers, you'll tell him up front in no uncertain terms. No more assumptions about what's confidential and what isn't. You remember what I used to tell you about assumptions, don't you? The minute you start making assumptions, you make an ass out of you and Umption, she smiled. I remember. Good. I just wish Kessler hadn't put quite so much umption into making an ass out of me. Especially the very day Victoria Santos comes into town. I have an uneasy, bad feeling about that guy. That's funny. He thinks highly of you. Really? He was impressed the way you came up with that bookend theory so quickly, even if it does turn out to be wrong. He never let me know he was impressed. He never would. Dick's kind of a pain, even a bit of a whiner. But overall, he's a damn fine detective. And if you're good, he respects you, even if he doesn't show it. Andy bought some speckled Chinese eggplant and stalks of lemongrass, then wandered farther down the arcade toward a stall filled with fresh and dried flowers. Isaac had stopped next door for a bag of pistachios. Her phone rang. She stepped behind a tall stack of wicker baskets and answered. It was Kessler, speaking of the devil. You asked me to call as soon as we got anything on Jane Doe. Well, we got an ID. Andy pressed a finger to her free ear to block out the market noise. Who is she? Name's Paula Jablinski. Just moved here from Wisconsin 3 weeks ago. She didn't even have a job yet. No friends or family in the area, which explains why nobody filed a missing persons report on her. Her mother in Milwaukee notified us today. Said her daughter hadn't returned her phone calls in over a week. From the description and dental records she faxed, looks like a fairly positive ID. Smart choice of victim, said Andy. No connections to the area, nobody misses her. Ideal victim. Especially if you're looking for a match for Colleen Easterbrook. Colleen didn't just move here. That's not what I meant. Get this. Paula Jablinski used to work for a Holiday Inn in Milwaukee. She was looking for work in Seattle in hotel management, just like Colleen Easterbrook. Just like Beth Wheatley, said Andy. So you think Jablinski and Easterbrook are a lone pair of bookends? Or are we just missing another cold one named Wheatley? I don't know. I'm not a gambler, he said, but my money's on the trifecta. Hate to say it, she said, as she stared blankly at a bundle of crumbling dried flowers. But I'm afraid mine is, too. Chapter 23. He was dressed entirely in black, a sleek silhouette in the early evening darkness. The rear basement window was the obvious point of entry. There was no alarm, no dog. The light burning in the kitchen was the same light she routinely left on whenever she left the house. A beacon of welcome for any would-be intruder. He covered the window with duct tape, then tapped it quietly, shattering the pane. The glass peeled away with the tape. He unlocked the window and entered in seconds. She was out for drinks after work, then probably dinner and a movie. He knew her routine, knew her circle of friends, knew she lived alone. Last night's stakeout had been only one of many. He had a pretty good idea when she would return home. It was just a matter of waiting, anticipating, preparing. Without a sound, he slid into the basement. Once his eyes adjusted to the darkness, he climbed the stairs. He had a pick with him, but the door was unlocked. It opened with a squeak. He peered inside. The oven light from the kitchen spilled into the hallway, dim but sufficient to guide him through the house. He moved quickly past the master bedroom, disturbing nothing. He went straight to the guest bedroom, again touching nothing. He slid the closet door open and stepped inside, closing it behind him. She wasn't likely to check there. She'd come home and go to bed in the master, completely unaware of what was waiting for her in the next room. His heart was pounding. Anticipation always fueled excitement. The risk heightened the thrill, a winner-take-all scenario. If someone had seen him enter, if she could somehow sense his presence, he was trapped, literally backed into a corner. But if he had gone undetected, and he knew he had, the night was completely his. Silently, he laid his leather bag at his feet. It contained everything he needed, his tools. He lowered himself to the closet floor and sat motionless. He noticed the clothes hanging overhead, could even smell them. This close to a kill, his senses were always heightened. Slivers of light seeped through the louvered closet door, painting stripes on his torso. From behind the closet door, he peered through the slats and checked out the room. A streetlight outside the house gave the room a faint yellow cast. The bed was in the corner. The door was directly across. He'd left it open, as he had found it, so he could see into the hall. He looked away. It could be hours before her return. He would have to stay alert. Usually, adrenaline kept him focused. Tonight, however, his mind wanted to wander. He closed his eyes tightly, then opened them, fighting off the distraction. No use. The setting was the problem, hiding inside the closet, the clothes hanging overhead, the narrow slats of light beaming through the louvered closet doors. The darkness, the silence, it was beginning to play tricks. He closed his eyes to escape the reminders, but there was no stopping the mental journey. He was going back in time, many years, to his childhood. He could see himself at home in his father's study, the one room in the house his father had declared off-limits. He did his work there, reviewing confidential files and materials from the Torture Victims Institute. It was only natural for a 10-year-old to be drawn to a room he was forbidden to enter. And it was only natural to run and hide in the closet at the sound of his father's footsteps approaching in the hallway. The door opened. He peered through the louvered slats and watched his father enter, praying he wouldn't check the closet. He didn't. He went straight for the window and pulled the blind shut. The room darkened. The closet turned even darker. He could barely see out. His heart raced at the sound of footsteps again, his father crossing the room. He closed his eyes and braced himself for the closet door to open, but it didn't. He heard a dresser drawer slide open, then close. He opened his eyes. His father had something in his hand, a video cassette, which he inserted into the VCR. The television switched on. The room brightened with its flickering glow. His father sank into his chair, his back to the closet. He and his father were faced in the same direction, watching the same videotape. The screen was pure snow at first, then a woman appeared. She was sitting on a chair, facing the camera. She wasn't too old, probably in her 30s. She had short, dark hair and skin that looked tanned. She looked nervous. She licked her lips a lot. Her hand was clenched into a fist. She wasn't beautiful, but pretty. Prettier than his mother, anyway. Finally, she spoke.
My name is Alicia Santiago.
And where are you from? The second voice startled him. It was his father. It was a taped interview, psychotherapist and patient.
Bogota, Colombia.
He watched for several minutes, never taking his eyes off the screen, almost forgetting that his father, too, was watching just a few feet away. The tape itself, with his father asking questions and the pretty woman answering, seemed more real. It intrigued him the way she would answer anything the therapist asked, even details about her marriage. Tell me more about your husband. She drew a deep breath.
He was a judge in the criminal courts. Many drug cases.
It would have been boring for a 10-year-old to watch, but for her expressions, her obvious pain. With each answer, she seemed more distressed. The tone of his father's questions never changed. It was the same monotone, very methodical. Tell me about that night, his father said. The night the men took you. Her voice shook.
There were three of them, I think. I don't remember exactly. I was asleep. They grabbed me in my bed, put something over my mouth. I tried to scream, but couldn't breathe. Then I blacked out.
They drugged you? She nodded. What do you remember next?
Waking up.
Where were you?
I don't know. I was blindfolded. It felt more like a cell than a room. A bare cement floor. Cold, very cold.
Were you dressed warmly?
No.
She lowered her head, embarrassed.
I was naked.
What happened to your clothes?
I don't know.
There was silence for a second. She sipped a cup of water. The camera never moved, locked on her distress. Alicia, I know this is difficult, but I want you to tell me what happened next, after you woke up.
I was afraid to move. I just lay on the floor.
How long?
Hard to say. Maybe a few minutes. Longer, possibly.
Then what?
Then I heard something outside the door.
Someone entering? She nodded, gnawing her lower lip nervously. Who was it? Her eyes welled. A hand appeared on screen, passing her a tissue. She took it and dabbed away a tear.
One of the men.
You were still blindfolded?
Yes.
What did you do?
Nothing, really. Tried to cover myself, my breasts, with my arms, but nothing else.
What did he do?
Came to me. I could hear his footsteps on the cement floor.
Just one man, you're sure?
I think so. He walked very slowly, very close to me. Then he stopped.
Did he say anything? She nodded, her face flushed with emotion.
He told me to kneel, she said, her voice cracking, and to open my mouth.
What did you do?
I did whatever he said.
Then what?
I just knelt there, waiting. I could see nothing, but I sensed him standing right there. I was afraid. I heard his belt unbuckling, his pants unzip. And then he shouted at me, "Wider!" And I would open my mouth, wider. It wasn't wide enough. He grabbed me.
Where?
My jaw, prying it apart.
Were you in pain? Tears flowed.
At this point, I was numb. I just braced myself, expecting him to, you know, put it in my mouth.
Did he? Her voice shook.
I couldn't see.
What did you feel?
Nothing at first. I sensed something was in my mouth, but it was sort of hovering.
Then what happened?
He shouted at me again, "Close!" So I closed my mouth.
And what did you feel?
Cold.
Cold, she nodded.
It was long and flat.
Flat?
Resting on my tongue, pushing on the roof of my mouth. After a few seconds, I could feel the blood oozing from the corners of my mouth.
Her eyes closed, then opened. She barely had control, her voice barely audible.
The edges were so sharp.
A knife? She trembled, then nodded.
He ordered me not to swallow. The blood gathered in my mouth. It had to go somewhere. My mouth was full. It was running down my chin.
Then what happened?
The flashing.
Lights?
I was still blindfolded, but it was like a strobe light sweeping in around the edges.
White light?
Yes.
You were imagining it?
No, it was real. A bright flash of light over and over.
What was it for?
I don't know. I didn't know.
Do you know now? She didn't answer. He asked again, "Do you know what it was?" She answered quietly,
Someone was taking pictures.
On screen, the sobbing continued. From the safety of the closet, his 10-year-old eyes never looked away, barely even blinked. Here was a woman on the verge of hysteria, yet he was strangely unfazed by the tears. For a second, he felt guilty, mesmerized by this woman's suffering as his father reviewed it for study so he could help her. But he couldn't tear his young eyes away from the screen. The taped interview continued. "What happened next?" his father asked.
"He pulled out the knife. Very fast. Cut like a razor."
"What then?"
"He asked me, 'Do you like the knife?'"
"Did you answer?"
"No. So he shouted again, 'Do you like the knife?'"
"Did you answer this time?"
"I just shook my head. Then he shouted again, 'Say it loud. Say you don't like the knife.' So I did. I shouted back. Over and over he made me shout it, 'I don't like the knife.'"
"Then what?"
She swallowed hard. "He whispered into my ear."
"What did he say?"
"Next time, be glad it's not the knife."
A deep groan emerged from the couch, clearly not from the videotape. The tape was switched off, controlled by the remote. Several seconds passed. His father didn't move. Then slowly he rose and turned around. The view from the closet was unobstructed. The look on his face was one of total exhaustion. But it wasn't his father's face that caught his attention. It was the unzipped fly, the spent erection. He was only 10, but he knew what was going on. This was no professional study session. A thud on the window roused him from his memories. He was out of the past, but still in the closet, a strange woman's closet. He peered through the slats in the louvered doors. Outside, the wind had kicked up again. A tree branch thrashed against the bedroom window. Nothing to be concerned about. Still, he chastised himself in silence. Too much at stake to let the mind drift away, especially into the past. He opened his eyes widely and stared toward the hallway, thinking only of the future. The immediate future. When it would be better than videotape.
This ends Disc 4, Under Cover of Darkness, Disc 5.
Chapter 24. Gus returned home after dinner time. Morgan was in her room with one of her friends. Carla had invited her over. A good move. Anything to take Morgan's focus off any child's worst fear. He knocked on her door and popped his head into the room. "Hi." She looked up from her computer. She and her friend were trying out a new dinosaur CD-ROM.
"Hi, Daddy."
"Who's your friend?"
"This is Hannah."
Her eyes were telling. That he had to ask only reinforced the uncomfortable note he had left on this morning.
"She's my best friend." "Hi,"
she peeped. "Hi, Hannah." They stared back in silence. Gus felt decidedly unwelcome. He backed out awkwardly. "Well, you two have fun." He closed the door. Even the simple exchanges were going badly. He slipped off his jacket and headed for the kitchen. Carla was in the family room watching television on the big 60-inch screen. One of those mindless magazine shows, Hard Edition or some such thing, where Armani-clad journalists ask megastars the really probing questions like, "Are you incredibly excited about your new movie?" He got a beer from the refrigerator and leaned on the granite counter facing the family room. Carla remained glued to the television. "I hired a private investigator today." She switched off the TV with the remote control.
"You did?"
"Spent most of the day with him." "Are you unhappy with the job the police are doing?" He opened the bottle and took a sip. "Honestly, they seem to have written her off for dead. I want to make sure they're not jumping to conclusions."
You mean you're coming around to my first thought, that she left you? I'm not ruling it out, though it does seem remote. Even if she was as unhappy as you say, that doesn't explain the way she left. Leaving Morgan without a ride at the youth center? Leaving without her purse or credit cards? It's all pretty confusing. And you think a private investigator can sort it out? No one seems to have a clue where she might have gone. I'm beginning to think maybe someone is covering for her. If that's the case, I'm hoping the private investigator can help. I hope so, too. He nodded, then set his half-empty beer bottle on the counter. Carla, did you know Beth had an eating disorder? She recoiled, but only slightly. The question didn't seem to floor her. Didn't you? No. How long did she have it? About as long as you've made her feel insecure, I guess. What did I ever do to make her feel so insecure? You're the only one who can answer that. Did she ever say anything to you? Lots of things. Anything specific? Anything she seemed preoccupied with? Yeah. Two words. Martha Goldstein. He went cold, recalling Martha's words in his office, the way Beth had shunned her at the firm Christmas party. I was never unfaithful to Beth, not with Martha, not with anyone. That's not the way Beth saw it. What did she tell you? She didn't show me any photographs of you and Martha in compromising positions, if that's what you're wondering. And that's not what bugged her anyway. To be honest with you, I think she could have found a way to forgive you if you'd gotten drunk, lost your head, and pulled a one-night stand with some woman you didn't care about. What she couldn't stand was the long, painful death, and it has to be painful, watching her husband slowly fall in love with another woman. I'm not in love with Martha Goldstein, he said with frustration. Maybe not, but somewhere along the line, you fell out of love with Beth. I've always loved Beth. I still love her. If she doubted that, she should have talked to me about it. If you didn't hear her throwing up, I guess she figured you weren't listening. Gus was looking at Carla, but didn't really see her. He was really looking inside himself, seeing things he didn't like. I'm beat. I'm going to lie down before dinner. All I made was soup and jello. It's in the fridge. Morgan's tooth is still bothering her. She likes chicken soup and jello when she's sick. Cherry. All the little things he didn't know about Morgan. The thought of having to learn them from Carla had him feeling not so good about himself. Guess I'll just order a pizza or something. You eat yet? No, but I need to get home. You think you can handle things on your own tonight? I think so. She grabbed her coat and started down the hall. Gus followed and opened the front door for her, then switched on the porch light. A chilly wind stirred the evergreens in the big front yard. Carla walked down the steps in silence. Thanks for watching Morgan, he said, standing in the doorway. She stopped and looked back. What's an aunt for? She started down the steps again, but stopped short, as if she had something to say. Gus? Yeah? She paused, measuring her words. Let me just say this to you. You may never have stopped loving Beth. In your own loyal and convenient way, you may even still love her. Her eyes began to well, her voice even quavered. But in the last 6 months, you really stopped knowing her. He watched in silence as she turned and walked to her car. The door closed slowly, leaving him alone with his thoughts in the dark and empty hallway. Chapter 25. The profile arrived by fax. 6 typed pages, double-spaced. Andy read it several times. It was her job to disseminate it, not critique it, but she couldn't help herself. She at least had to compare it to what she had come up with. On several key points, she was on Victoria's same wavelength. A man in his late 20s or early 30s, Caucasian, same as his victims, higher than average intelligence. Doesn't know his victims, likely to have experienced a recent stressful event in his life, such as job loss, divorce, or breakup with his girlfriend.
But the heart of it was somewhat different from what Andy had envisioned. Leads a normal and even respectable lifestyle by day. A roamer by night, possibly insomniac. No felony convictions, but arrest record includes peeping Tom or trespassing offenses. Fancies himself smarter than police. No formal police training, but probably self-educated through books and magazines on police procedures and perhaps even profiling techniques. Subscribes to detective magazines. Frequents bars or restaurants where law enforcement personnel gather. May even befriend or strike up conversations with cops to fit in. A law enforcement reject, possibly a security guard who didn't make the police cut. Andy's overall impression was disappointment. She wasn't expecting a name and address. Profiles were, by their nature, generalizations. But this one struck Andy as a little too general. It didn't exhibit the genius Victoria Santos was. But what do I know? She scrambled to get the profile delivered to each of the local law enforcement agencies before 6:30. Then it was off to her usual Friday routine, yoga classes. Andy rarely missed, especially when the stress level at work was high. Nothing like the downward-facing dog pose to get your mind off work, even if it wasn't nearly as kinky as it sounded. Andy parked in the paved lot on the corner, across the street and a half block down from the studio. Beneath her coat, she wore a clingy aerobic leotard. Her workout bag was over her shoulder. Inside were the usual yoga props, a thin rubber sticky mat, a strap, and two wooden blocks. The yoga instructor banned cell phones and beepers from class. Fortunately, he had never said anything about the firearm an FBI agent was required to carry. That, too, was in her bag. The yoga studio shared space with a ballet company in a low-rent area. The office building across the street was 80 years old and looked even older. The red brick warehouse next door was abandoned and slated for demolition. The handful of restaurants nearby were strictly for the lunch crowd, all closed by late afternoon. It wasn't an unsafe neighborhood, but it wasn't for the faint-hearted either. Most students came in groups. Andy, late as usual, came alone. She locked her car and headed briskly down the sidewalk. Her sneakers squeaked on the damp cement. A lone car passed, spraying the curb with foul-smelling runoff. Andy danced out of the way and continued up the block. It was a straight shot to the studio, with the entrance to the dark alley beside the warehouse her only real safety concern. She made it a practice never to cross the street till she was past it. In less than a minute, she was there. Seeing no degenerates in the shadows, she jumped off the curb and cut across the street. A truck passed. The sound of tires on wet pavement faded behind her. It was replaced by footsteps. Andy quickened her pace. The footsteps quickened. Leather heels, she could tell, probably a man. She slowed her pace just to test. The footsteps were closing. Paranoid already. All this serial killer stuff. Just to be safe, she stepped off the curb, pretending to cross the street. The sound changed from the sharp click of heels on the cement sidewalk to the more muffled heels on asphalt. She hopped back on the sidewalk. Again, the footsteps followed. This was not paranoia. She unzipped her bag and grabbed her pistol, leaving it inside. She stopped and wheeled around. He stopped. The gun was still inside her bag, but it was pointing at the chest of her ex-fiancé. "Rick!" she gasped. "What the hell are you doing?" He wobbled slightly as though he'd been drinking.
Just nothing.
His eyes were glazed. He'd definitely been drinking.
"You're following me. I have something to say to you."
"Rick, leave me alone.
I didn't sleep with your sister."
"I know you didn't. You fucked her." He smiled, struggling not to laugh, but he couldn't hold it in. It was funny to a drunk. He finally got control of himself.
"Oh, that was rich."
Inside the bag, her finger twitched on the trigger. Her darker side wondered if this could pass for justifiable homicide.
"You think it's funny that you had sex with my sister the night before our wedding?"
The laughter faded, but the smirk was still there. Come on, Andy. You hate your sister anyway. The only reason she was maid of honor is because your mother made you pick her. And that's supposed to make what you did okay? She came on to me. I wasn't looking for it. She checked her watch, ready to go. What do you want from me? What do you think? Okay, you're forgiven. No hard feelings. Now drop dead and get out of my life. She turned away. He stepped toward her and grabbed her arm. She stopped and shot a look. Don't touch me. He squeezed tighter. You made a fucking fool out of me. You are a fool. Now take your hand off me. His face reddened. His grip tightened. What are you going to do, Andy? She looked him straight in the eye. For a second, he looked like he was going to kiss her. On impulse, her knee came up and caught him squarely in the groin. He doubled over and fell to the pavement. He was groaning, then dry heaving. He got up on one knee but could climb no further. His eyes filled with rage. You are gonna pay for this, bitch. She returned the glare. Send me a bill, she said, then turned away. I mean it, he shouted. I'll make you pay. Andy just kept on walking. Listen to me. His senseless shouting followed her down the sidewalk, ceasing only when Andy was inside the building. After Carla left, Gus was tired enough to sleep, but his mind wouldn't allow it. The lights were off, the master bedroom was dark, he was flat on his back, eyes wide open, staring at the ceiling. As his pupils adjusted to the darkness, the jewelry box on the bureau caught his attention. A thought crossed his mind that bordered on panic. He couldn't remember if he had told the FBI if Beth had been wearing any jewelry when she'd disappeared. Maybe he could tell from the box. A ring or some other distinctive item might conceivably help identify her, if the worst of Agent Henning's suspicions were true. He switched on the lamp and rose from the bed. It was a beautiful antique box made of burled walnut. It used to play music, but that had died years ago. Metaphorical, in a way. He opened it carefully and peered inside. It was well organized. Earrings and less expensive pieces were in the felt-lined squares on top. Larger and more precious pieces filled the bottom. He noticed right away the engagement ring was there. The wedding ring was missing. He wasn't sure what to make of that, whether she'd worn it faithfully till the day she had disappeared, or symbolically discarded it as she walked out the door. It was difficult to account for everything, but as best he could tell, everything else he had ever given her was still there. A pear-shaped diamond necklace, a diamond and emerald bracelet. Some of the items were almost too precious to keep in the house. Strangely, the only stones that evoked any emotion were the smallest of all. He'd bought her a pair of diamond chip earrings for her 20th birthday, the first they had celebrated together. Years later, after he'd started making real money, it used to make him smile inside when Beth would still wear those tiny little earrings. He held them in the palm of his hand. Two sparkling specks, not much bigger than flecks of glitter. Beth used to wear them on anniversaries of certain milestones in their early love life. Silly little things, like the date of their first kiss, the first time he'd said, I love you. It was a shame he had never told her how good it made him feel to see them on her, how much he appreciated the sentimentality. She probably thought he hadn't noticed. He had. He'd noticed most when she'd stopped. She'd stopped when she'd gotten pregnant, when a lot of things seemed to change. It hadn't been an easy pregnancy, though it had started out happily enough. They had talked about furniture shopping together and painting the nursery. He'd even made it to the first three office visits and signed them up for Lamaze classes. He was adamant about being a partner in the experience. Then things blew up at work. He had to go to New York for 6 weeks to help save his biggest corporate client from a hostile takeover attempt. When he returned home, Beth had changed, not just physically, though the difference between her fifth month and the seventh was undeniably dramatic, especially to a husband who had been away.
It was more a matter of her mindset and personality. She seemed worn down by the constant nausea, and it did seem constant. Early in the morning and late at night, Gus heard the honking from behind the closed bathroom door. Beth had called it morning sickness, and he had accepted the explanation at face value, knowing better than to argue with a pregnant woman. Now, however, he wasn't so sure. He was thinking of what Dr. Shippey had said, how the enamel on her teeth suggested that her eating disorder had been going on for a long time. Those awful sounds from the bathroom might well have been the early signs of trouble. He remembered how Beth had seemed almost happy about the nausea in the first couple of months, because it had kept her weight down. In hindsight, she'd seemed unduly intrigued by the rare reported cases of women with nausea throughout their entire pregnancy. Maybe it wasn't nature that had extended her morning sickness beyond the normal 13 weeks. It might well have been as vulgar as a finger down the throat. Had he not been so busy, maybe he would have taken a different look at her obsession with gaining no more than 18 pounds, her insistence on wearing her tight blue jeans just as soon as the cesarean scar healed, her crying jag when she couldn't button them. Something more than pregnancy and hormones was going on, but Gus had let it go. He'd let too many things go in the last few years. And, as Carla had said, it came with a price. He'd stopped knowing his own wife. He wondered what exactly that meant. Was she criticizing him for not being sensitive to her needs? Or was she telling him that if Beth came back today, if he sat down and really talked to her, he'd literally find he didn't even know her? Whatever she'd meant, the entire train of thought was leading him in one direction. He was becoming ever more intrigued by something he'd been afraid to check out. Something he could never have believed was true. Until now. Gus put the earrings back in the box and went to the walk-in closet. It was huge, with rows and rows of his business suits on the left. To the right was Beth's space. It was more like a room than a closet. A silk-covered settee faced the big triple mirror. The lighting was indirect, candescent, not the fluorescent kind that made it more difficult to determine subtle shades of color and fabrics. The shelves and built-in drawers were solid maple. Nearly an entire wall was devoted just to shoes and sweaters. Hanging clothes lined the other three walls, organized from casual to formal, left to right. He opened a few drawers randomly, seeing nothing unusual. He flipped through some skirts and dresses on hangers, then stopped. One dress still had the tags on it. He pulled it down. It had an Empire waistline. Beth hated that style. He remembered how she'd nearly died when an old sorority sister had gotten married and all the bridesmaids had to wear burnt orange gowns with Empire waistlines. She felt like the long, glowing end of those flashlights cops use to direct traffic. It was funny at the time, not so funny now. Gus scanned the rack for a dress he was sure she had worn. He found the beaded evening gown she'd worn to the firm's Christmas party and checked the label. It was size 6. He glanced at the other dress. Size 12. He draped it over his arm and quickly searched the rack for more dresses with tags. He found a sundress, size 10. A wool skirt, size 2. Quickly he did the same with the shoes on the shelves against the other wall. He found a pair of heels she used to wear and a pair of hiking boots, both size 7. On the bottom shelf was a leather boot with no mate. The tag still on the sole, never been worn, size 11. A beige pump, size 4. Again, no mate. He felt chills down his spine. He stared into the triple mirror, seeing himself from all angles, his arms full of odd-sized clothes his wife could never wear. It was just as Morgan had said. She was stealing things, just for the sake of stealing. Clothes that didn't fit. Odd shoes with their mates still in the back storage room at Nordstrom's. She was filling her closet with useless trophies of the hunt. "Dear God," he said softly, "what happened to you, Beth?" Chapter 26. She was alive. He could feel it. With two latex-covered fingers pressed against her neck, he detected a hint of a heartbeat. She was unconscious, but slowly coming back for another round. The discovery thrilled him, as if her fading pulse were pumping the blood through his own veins, the icy cold blood. After weeks of anticipation, all the tedious preparation, this was the payoff. Everything had gone exactly according to plan. For nearly 3 hours, he had waited patiently inside the closet in the guest bedroom. Around 11, he'd heard her car pull up in the driveway. The front door opened and closed. The keys jingled in the lock. Her heels clicked on the tile floor. Through the slats in the louvered closet door, he watched her pass in the lighted hallway. He heard the toilet flush, listened as she brushed her teeth. The lights went out. The bed squeaked gently beneath the weight of her body. The television played for 20 minutes, then was switched off. It was an instant rush, routine noises that telegraphed her complete unawareness. It made him want to spring early, but he contained himself, sticking to the schedule. He waited. With time, silence filled the house. He allowed another 30 minutes for her to fall asleep. And then he'd made his move. Quietly, out of the closet, then down the hall, dressed in a hooded black bodysuit that rendered him invisible in the darkness. The hunting knife was in its sheath, strapped to his forearm. A set of plastic handcuffs was in one hand. His strangulation stick was in the other. The bedroom door was open. He stood in the doorway, opposite the bay window on the far wall. Outside, a big full moon radiated just enough light to cast shadows across the room. A collage of framed photographs covered another wall. A queen-size bed faced the bureau. His analytic eye traced the gentle curve of her body beneath the blankets. She lay on her right side, facing away from him. She was surely asleep, but he would wait for the furnace to kick on before closing in. The hum from the blowers would muffle his footsteps. He stood motionless for several minutes, watching over her, never flinching a muscle. Finally, the furnace tripped. A stream of warm air poured from the vents. The lace curtains on the windows began to stir. That was his cue. He hooked the plastic cuffs to his belt. He put his arm through the loop of his strangulation stick and brought it up around his right shoulder. Both hands were free. He took 4 steps closer, right to the edge of the bed. She was easily within his grasp. Half her sleepy face was hidden beneath the covers, but he knew exactly what she looked like. He knew all about her. She met the essential requirements. Brown hair, brown eyes, mid-30s. A very suitable selection, given the compressed time frame. He took a deep, silent breath, then unleashed his fury in one fluid motion. He grabbed her hip and shoulder and jerked her backward, arching her spine against his knee with such force that it cracked the 7th vertebra. He dragged her to the floor, flat on her stomach. Her limbs flailed as he mounted her, nearly 200 muscular pounds planted firmly on her kidneys. He extended his arms, and with cupped hands he slapped her simultaneously on the ears. It stunned her long enough for him to gain control and lock her wrists behind her back in the plastic cuffs. He jerked her upward and set her on the edge of the bed. She screamed once. The strangulation stick dropped over her head and tightened quickly, silencing her. It was a simple but lethal device. A 2-foot loop of nylon rope attached at both ends to an 8-inch wooden handle. It allowed him to twist with one hand and choke his victim, leaving the other free to control her. He knelt behind her on the bed as the rope twisted and tightened around her neck. The blood flow to her brain stopped. She weakened with each breathless moment. He propped her up with his free arm, around her waist, beneath the ribcage, like half a Heimlich maneuver. As long as she was alive, he wouldn't let her fall. She sat facing the mirror. He was directly behind her facing the mirror, too, though his face was unrecognizable behind the ski mask.
There was just enough light to show the reflection. In every attack, there had to be a mirror. It was the only way his victims could watch themselves being strangled. Her legs kicked, her body tightened with resistance. The futility of her efforts only heightened his excitement, underlined his total control. This one had fought for nearly half an hour. The fight, however, was on his terms. Every few minutes he would give a twist of the right hand and tighten the noose. She would groan and squirm, then slowly lose consciousness. And then, at precisely the right moment, he would release. The loop at the end of the strangulation stick would loosen. Her swan-like neck would lose the hourglass effect. The air passages would reopen. Blood flow to and from the brain would resume. The purple ring of bruises around the neck would swell, then throb. Slowly, her near-dead body would return to life. He could enjoy it all over again. 3 times so far. And now she was coming back, again. She coughed lightly. Once more, she was gaining strength. He could feel the change in her neck and shoulders. She was no longer dead weight. This was unprecedented. 4 times, up and down, and then up again. Either she was an amazing fighter, or he was getting better. More likely the former. He was already the best. He knew just how far to take it, how tight to squeeze, how long to hold it. It had taken years of training, much of it at the expense of his own neck muscles. All those afternoons in his garage as a teenager, standing on a ladder, hanging by the neck with his makeshift pulley. Practice had made perfect. He knew what it was like on the other side. The rope had taken him there. More important, he knew the way back. He could show others the way, too. He could bring anyone back. Or not. Her face was red and puffy. Blood oozed from her tongue and lips where she'd bitten herself. Her eyes blinked open, locking with his in the mirror. Hers were glassy and bloodshot. His were dark, narrow slits. He gave the stick a swift turn, harder than the last time, farther than before. The noose tightened and crushed the larynx. Her body stiffened, then quickly went limp. She had little fight left. The struggle was over. This one was not coming back. He released the tension on the rope, staring closely at a face that no longer showed expression. The brief excitement faded, then turned to disappointment. The anger should have subsided, but it was only getting stronger. This close-up, eye to eye with his victim, beyond the flurry of the kill, his mistake was evident. This one just didn't look enough like Beth Wheatley. Part 3. Chapter 27. Andy finished her Monday morning run in record time. The clouds even parted as she crossed the imaginary finish line outside her townhouse. A quick 3 miles with a sprint kick finish had left her sweaty and exhausted. The phone rang just as she reached her back door. She had not yet caught her breath as she raced inside the kitchen and grabbed it in mid-ring. It was Gus.
"Good morning," she said,
each syllable separated by heavy breathing. "Did I catch you in the middle of something?"
"No, not... it's not that," she said,
realizing she had the distinct breathlessness of recent orgasm. "I better call back later."
"It's okay, really." She drew a few more breaths. "I was jogging."
"Oh," he sounded relieved. She pulled the scrunchie from her knotted hair, letting it fall.
"What's up?"
"I hate to bother you at home so early, but I've been thinking about something all weekend that I really need to talk to you about. With your psychology background and all, I thought you might be able to help."
"Sure, be happy to."
"It's about Beth. She seems to have been in some kind of trouble, even before she disappeared, I mean." He had her attention. Andy sank into a chair at the kitchen table as he told her about the bulimia, the shoplifting. She got up once to grab the magnetic message pad from the refrigerator door,
then jotted down a few notes with a phone tucked beneath her chin. It took him several minutes to recount everything. She listened carefully, interjecting only a few uh-huhs and I sees along the way. As he spoke, however, she was internally debating whether to tell him on the phone that the evidence was more than ever pointing to Beth as a likely victim. When he finished, there was silence. Andy said, "Would you mind if I stop by your house this morning?"
"Well, that'd be fine, I guess. What do you have in mind?"
She caught herself, careful not to use the term victimology with a man who might not be ready to label his wife a victim. It would be helpful for me to see where Beth lived, how she lived. Maybe even look at some of those things you think she shoplifted. Then we can talk more.
That sounds like a good idea.
I can be there in about an hour.
Great. See you then.
The Wheatley house was even more impressive than Andy had expected. The brick Tudor-style estate was set well back from the street, hidden behind an 8-foot hedge that lined the imposing stone fence and decorative iron gate. A long, curved driveway sloped up toward the house. It was set on the highest point on the heavily wooded lot, perched just above the neighbor's trees for unobstructed views of Puget Sound. Andy parked beneath the portico and rang the doorbell. Gus answered. He looked tired, as though he'd barely slept all night.
"Come in," he said, letting her pass. The double doors closed behind her. She stood beneath the crystal chandelier in the foyer, facing the living room. It was a dramatic room with vaulted ceilings that followed the steep lines of the Tudor design. The floor was oak with inlaid borders of teak and rosewood. A huge stone fireplace covered one wall. Museum-quality artwork covered another. The furnishings were expensive European designs she had admired only in storefront windows. In the center was a silk oriental rug, big enough to carpet her entire townhouse.
"Nice place," she said as Gus took her coat.
"It's cozy."
"Right, my Subaru is cozy."
He asked, "Can I get you something? Coffee?"
"That'd be perfect."
He directed her toward the kitchen, but they were practically ambushed halfway down the hall as Morgan emerged from her bedroom. Gus said,
"This is my daughter, Morgan."
Andy leaned forward to extend her hand.
"I'm Andy." "Andy? That's a boy's name."
"No more than Morgan," she said, smiling thinly. That seemed to break the ice as if they had a kinship.
"I lost a tooth," she said as she pointed at the gap.
"Oh, my. Does it hurt?"
"A little. Enough to keep me out of school today."
"I see," said Andy, smiling with her eyes.
"Are you going to find my mommy?"
Andy and Gus exchanged glances. She sensed the FBI was as yet an unsettled matter between father and daughter.
"I'm here to help your dad."
A phone rang. Morgan pulled a cordless receiver from her Barbie shoulder bag and answered,
"Hi, Hannah."
"Sounds like somebody found a friend to play hooky with," Andy said with a wink. Morgan blushed, guilty as charged. She waved a quick goodbye and started down the hall, then stopped and glanced back.
"You can come see my room sometime, Andy, if you want."
"I'd like that." Morgan seemed to smile as she ducked into her room. Gus watched, bewildered.
"How the heck did you do that?"
"It's a girl thing.
Works better than the lousy dad thing, I guess.